Which brings us to a new and possibly more environmentally friendly way to produce oil. It involves plastic, you know, like those soda bottles you discard. Only 7% of plastic waste in the U.S. is recycled each year, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, a startup company in Niagara Falls says it can increase that amount while also reducing the country's dependence on foreign oil. For member station WBFO, Daniel Robison has more.
This machine's known as the plastic eating monster. Thousands of pounds of shredded milk jugs, water bottles, and grocery bags tumble into a large tank where it's melted together and vaporized. This waste comes from landfills and dumps from all over the United States.
Basically, they've been mining their own piles for us and sending them here.
John Bordnick runs his namesake company, JBI Inc. He's invented a process that converts plastic into oil by rearranging its hydrocarbon chains. According to tests by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, JBI's patented technology is efficient, with close to 90% of plastics coming out as fuel. Bordnick says that makes the case for this kind of recycling to go mainstream.
When there have been attempts in the past to make fuel from plastic, it's been a low quality, low flash point, kind of sludgy. In this case here, we're making a very highly refined, consistent product that's within specifications of any standardized fuel.
JBI executive Bob Moladinha points to a spout at the other end of the plastic eating machine dripping a thin brown liquid.
You could tap this right now and this is ready to go. That's a number six fuel. That's what a lot of like U.S. Steel uses, a lot of major companies. That's what they pay the big bucks for, right there.
Each barrel of oil costs about $10 to produce, which JBI can sell for around $100 through a national distributor. The young company is already producing a few thousand gallons of oil a day. They've signed lucrative deals to set up operations next to companies with large volumes of plastic waste. But in its rush to grow, JBI has been accused by the SEC of overvaluing some of its assets in order to raise more funds. And John Bordnick says it's been hard to find acceptance from potential oil buyers because JBI's product has been dubbed a green fuel.
We don't make a synthetic other product that has problems. We make an in-spec fuel like everyone else. In fact, if anything, the word alternative has a stigma attached to it, more so because of prior attempts.
If JBI has its way, plastics will become a significant source of domestic fuel that reduces the country's dependence on foreign oil. But just how green is JBI's recycling when it produces a fossil fuel that pollutes just like any other?
To enter themselves into this industry, I think that they've all bought into the idea of producing a fuel.
Carson Maxted is with Resource Recycling, the plastic recycling industry's trade journal. He's not sure whether converting plastic to oil can be considered recycling or even environmentally friendly. But he says JBI's methods can coexist and even complement current recycling practices.
So they're getting value from something that would otherwise go to the landfill because the plastics most of them are looking for, the plastics that are either not easily recycled, they're of low quality or mixed plastic types, or they're dirty, things that wouldn't be accepted into a recycler.
And since there's no lack of plastic supply or demand for oil, Maxted says this technology has the potential to transform both industries. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Robison in Buffalo, New York.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Biancooley. This Sunday, Discovery Channel presents the first two installments of Frozen Planet, its newest nature documentary made in collaboration with England's BBC TV. It's from the same team that produced the brilliantly photographed Planet Earth, and I love this new TV series just as much. But once again, I have the same single complaint, the one grating flaw in an otherwise exceptional television program. I don't want to complain about Frozen Planet, however, until I dish out a little praise. Frozen Planet is the kind of program that television was made for, and, even more certainly, the kind that modern TV was made for. This series not only takes us, quite literally, to the coldest, most remote places on Earth, but captures images of so much majesty, artistry, and clarity, it's almost ridiculous. On a large-screen, high-definition TV, watching Frozen Planet is like having your own personal IMAX theater. The newest technology affects not only how we see these images, but how they're photographed. Even since Planet Earth was made a handful of years ago, advances in video technology have allowed camera crews, armed with the latest equipment, to capture action in unprecedented ways. There's even time-lapse photography so precise and so carefully planned out that it pans and zooms while telescoping weeks and months into less than a minute. The result is a glacier that advances like a slow-motion bulldozer, crushing and moving everything in its path. The images are fantastic. A mammoth elephant seal, protecting his claim to a female, engages in a furious bloody fight with an encroaching male. And if he's successful, he has to fight again, almost once an hour for several days, each time battling a fresh, determined rival. At the end, we see a dazed, bloody, obviously exhausted elephant seal making his way back to his mate. He may not be wondering whether she was worth it all, but I sure was. And that's the thing about any nature documentary done well. One thing it should do is make us cherish and think about the beauty and value and fragility of the natural world. More on that in a minute. The other thing it should do is make us empathize with the natural drama of everyday survival. Television has been doing this quite effectively ever since The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau and the nature specials presented by Walt Disney. And it's true that in many places in Frozen Planet, the narration, the music, and the simple storytelling combine to make it all feel like a much higher tech equivalent of one of those Disney programs. Narrator Alec Baldwin, in the episode called Spring, describes the nest-building efforts of some Antarctic penguins. The males, he explains, build nests out of small pebbles on patches of dry land because eggs would freeze within minutes if resting on snow or ice. And in this scene, the camera tracks one male penguin as he makes the long trek to find and return with one pebble at a time. The camera also catches a neighbor penguin who waits until the other's back is turned to steal his rock. This happens again and again, and everything about the way it's presented makes it look and sound like a silent film comedy or a classic Disney nature moment.
The hapless victim seems completely unaware he's being robbed blind. But somehow, the more rocks he gathers, the smaller his nest becomes. Meanwhile, the thief's nest is coming along nicely, probably because he keeps a sharp eye out for rock robbers. After all, it takes one to know one.
And that leads to my problem with Discovery Channel's Frozen Planet. As with Planet Earth, where the American network hired Sigourney Weaver to replace the original narration by Sir David Attenborough, this time Alec Baldwin gets the call. Attenborough survives, however, on the most important episode of the series, called On Thin Ice, because that's the one where he speaks from very personal experience as more than 50 years as a BBC nature documentary filmmaker about how and why the Earth is changing, and, yes, globally warming. Replacing Attenborough for any of these shows is very insulting. But everything else about Frozen Planet is very inspiring. Even the Making Of episode is a winner. Listen to Mark, a cameraman who's waited weeks to capture the moment when a frozen waterfall suddenly thaws, as he finally and barely gets the angle and the daylight to get the shot he needs. Baldwin sets the stage.
In the middle of the night, as the Frozen Planet team feared, the town was alerted that the frozen waterfall was about to break.
They just called a full evacuation of the island where we're staying. If we don't move now, we're all going to be underwater and possibly get trapped here for a few days.
They had to race to the waterfall, hoping that it didn't give way before daybreak. It held off, and they got there just in time.
That is a serious amount of ice coming around the corner. After weeks of waiting, sleeping giant of a river, we thought nothing was going to happen, and suddenly, look at this! This is what we're here for. Unbelievable! Absolutely unbelievable!
The executive producer of Frozen Planet, Alastair Fothergill, has worked on Planet Earth, Blue Planet, and Attenborough's classic The Trials of Life. The two even teamed up for a previous visit to the Antarctic almost 20 years ago for a fine series called Life in the Freezer. But it's good to know, somehow, that with all this knowledge, all these brilliant filmmakers, and all this modern equipment, many times getting just the right shot at just the right time is a matter of dumb, simple luck. And that makes me feel very lucky to be able to sit back in the comfort of my own home and watch the astonishing results.
Shell Oil is planning to begin oil drilling off the north coast of Alaska this summer, and those who support the new exploration say it will increase domestic oil production, reducing the need to rely on foreign supplies. Those opposed say it puts the fragile Arctic environment at risk. The debate has put native Alaskans in a very uncomfortable spot. They can't seem to agree on which is more important, oil revenues or environmental protection. That tension has been on display as members of the Inupiat tribe have traveled here to Washington, D.C. to argue their positions. And NPR's Richard Harris has more.
The last place on Earth you might expect to find a pro-whaling press conference is in a Greenpeace meeting room. But that actually took place thanks to the alliances formed to fight Arctic oil drilling. Environmental activists know one of their strongest arguments is to speak out to protect a traditional culture. That includes whale hunts. That's how Caroline Cannon came to be at Greenpeace. She's the former mayor of Point Hope, which she calls the whaling capital.
We rely on the whale, the bowhead whale. It is our identity. It is who we are. And the thought of offshore drilling or an oil spill is very terrifying.
She and her companions portrayed this whaling activity as part of their subsistence culture. And Point Hope resident Rosemary Atongarok says hunting is not simply part of the Inupiat heritage.
We need the foods from our lands and waters to feed our families. We cannot afford to buy the foods that come up to the Arctic. The cost of transportation increased these costs so that it could take your whole paycheck to try to feed your family from the store.
But that culture has seen a dramatic shift in recent decades, and it's because of oil money. The median household income in Point Hope is $77,000. Native corporations have invested billions of dollars from oil revenue and now benefit from that income. In fact, there's so much oil money in Alaska, citizens get a check from the state every year instead of paying income tax. Edward Itta spoke at another Washington event about Arctic drilling. He's the former mayor of the North Slope Borough. That's a vast area of northern Alaska, including Point Hope. He campaigned for office opposing offshore oil development.
My initial attitude had been not only no, but hell no, over my dead body.
But once he got into office, he realized what it took to keep the enormous county running.
Our tax base is based on oil and gas. There's nothing else there. We have schools, airports, roads, landfills, health facilities, hospitals, decent homes, keep warm now and have light and power, which when I grew up, we didn't have.
And the North Slope's biggest source of oil, Prudhoe Bay, is running low. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is working at one-third its capacity, and oil revenues are shrinking. That leaves the potentially vast deposits of offshore oil. Itta is worried about a spill, of course, but he seemed more worried that Shell might load offshore oil directly onto tankers and not pay the fee to pipe the oil through Alaska.
If there was no economic benefit up there, we would be opposed, period.
Mayor Itta's point of view is not news to the people from Point Hope. Rosemary Atongarok says if it comes down to choosing her traditional culture or oil money, she'll take the culture.
Others have goals of lofty wants out there, but when it's the goals of protecting who and what we are as a people and keeping us healthy in our tradition and cultures, this is a conflict that we cannot meet.
And she says the oil will eventually be gone. What will they do after that? Richard Harris, NPR News.